Hello and welcome back to the Unseen Incidents podcast. It's me, your host, Patrick Van Straten, and on this week's episodes, we're talking Chelsea. What do we think of their start to the season? What are the early returns on Maresca? How good is Cole Palmer, and where do we think they'll end up this season? Then we open up the burn book. Before over on the paid side, we look at Newcastle. What can we make of the standoff between Eddie Howe and Paul Mitchell, and could Newcastle seek to upgrade on the English coach? Then we're bringing you our hot take battle. Me and Pete, we're trading off our hottest takes to decide who is the biggest arsehole. That's all on this week's episodes of Unseen Incidents. So, back for another couple of episodes. How are you doing, Pete? How are things?
Things are very well. Things are very well. Excited to be here. Opened a bottle of wine. Excited for the evening. In a bit of a fluster getting here. Getting back from work, trains were a nightmare. Terrible place London is, and would not recommend it anybody to live anywhere near it. Unfortunately, I've married a person from here, so I'm literally stuck. But yeah, delighted to have gotten home and opened a bottle of wine. How are things with you, Patrick?
Good, man. Good. I don't think I've got anything to report, really. Like, what have I been up to? I've got a drink in front of me. I made a drink. It was too strong. It was G&T. It was too strong. And so I was just like, you know, a way that I can make it stronger while making it like more palatable is to add a bunch of Saint-Germain. So I've now added a lot of Saint-Germain. So it's kind of like an elderflower G&T. I've got a Negroni sitting here as well, like a canned Negroni, a moth Negroni.
Oh yeah, yeah. Is that one of the packages that I send you?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, interesting.
Yeah, they're good. I've had these before.
Are they better than Spicy Margs? Because that's a different brand.
The Spicy Margs truly are excellent.
Okay.
But I also think, okay, so I think any margarita, the floor level margarita is still pretty decent, right? Whereas a Negroni, I think, really does need to be like tailored to your specifications. Like when I make a Negroni, I don't really know how I make a Negroni, but when I make one, I'm like, that isn't right. Like it should have more of it. And I adjust it and adjust it and adjust it until it kind of hits like optimal sort of, you know, miscegenation.
Yeah, I'm personally not the biggest fan of Negronis. They can miss me, and I wouldn't be that annoyed. Margaritas are something that came into my life quite recently, shockingly recently, within the last couple of years. I was always scarred by tequila because my experience of tequila was you're like absolute paint thinner tequila that you get in the same clubs that sell like VKs, like the uni tequila.
The one with the sombrero on.
Anything like that is the bottom shelf tequila that gets served as shots in shit clubs. And for whatever reason, I was in the minority where like Sambuca of that standard, completely fine. Like I will do a shot of Sambuca 100 times over before I do a shot of shit tequila, because whatever it is about me and my palate, it almost like automatically makes me gag or sick. Like it's staggering the reflex of like my body trying to reject shit tequila. So I basically just went completely off tequila. I never even considered it. Didn't consider tequila cocktails. And then kind of got introduced to better tequila. I think actually at the Waitrose Food and Drink Festival, you know, that's very peak Pete Dorman. And then now I think tequila cocktails are probably my favourite cocktails. It's a toss-up between them and whiskey. Probably tequila. I just think it's more interesting flavour profile in a cocktail.
And it's a lighter alternative. Like it's like a whiskey cocktail is obviously like dark. And often there comes a point where you're like, I could just have like a whiskey.
Yeah.
Or a rum or something. Like, whereas tequila cocktails, I think, are naturally lend themselves to like summery drinks, like a Paloma, a Margarita. Like these are like happy, upbeat drinks, which you can like net quite a few of.
Yeah.
And they don't feel like they have to be had in the evening. They're good daytime cocktails as well, I think.
I think also the whiskey cocktail I tend to go for will be a sour, which in my opinion is a good cocktail, but a better version of that experience is a spicy margarita. Or just any margarita. It's like a similar alcohol taste, but also then you get the sourness, the bitterness.
I mean, look,
they're different, but yeah. it was a gateway.
I'm a fan of all the sours. I think a Pisco sour is like potentially a top three cocktail for me.
Well, you've gone off the spritzes, haven't you? You've soured on the spritzes.
They always have a place in my heart, but I think, you know, like, you go through a summer, you know, sometimes you go to a thing and you're like, I've had like 6 Aperol spritzes today. They're kind of all sickly sweet. Some of them were like not that good. Like, and just by the end of it, you think, I'd rather have this extremely sparingly. It's kind of the way that when you're like 12, your parents have a party or something, and you have like Pimm's for the first time. And you're just like, oh, this is fucking incredible. And then 2 years later, you're just like, if I never see a glass of Pimm's again, I will be so happy. I just never, ever need to drink one.
Pimm's is shit. Pimm's is shit.
It's shit. But like when you're 12, you're just like, it tastes like sweets, but it's alcohol. This is amazing. And your parents will like let you have it. Like let you drink like a whole glass of it rather than like, oh, of course you can have a sip of my wine or my port or whatever.
I remember we were in a pub in Grimsport, which is like a place on like the coast of Northern Ireland, not far from where I'm from. And my uncle gave me, it was the first time I'd ever drank. It was in a pub. It was like, we were there for the football or whatever. And my uncle just like slid me a blue WKD and I was like 12. this was like 2002, probably 2003. And just very much on the sly. And I was like, this is like the nicest thing I've ever drank. Fast forward now.
Smirnoff Ice.
21 years and... all alcohol pops are fucking horrendous.
Yeah, though I haven't had one since uni. And I've got to say, I have some affection for them because my college bar would, they would have like 3 alcohol pops for a fiver.
Mm-hmm.
And so the go-to move at the beginning of a bop, which is what like they call the party in college.
Of course it is.
Yeah, I know.
A bop.
Is like... My friend Ella and I would go and get like 3 of these and potentially another 3 afterwards. Straw-pedo all 3.
Yeah.
You'd then be like doubled up in agony for like 5 minutes while all the carbonation sort of settled in your stomach.
Mm-hmm.
And then after all the bubbles had like kind of, you know, popped basically, you would feel superhuman. Like, because you get this massive rush of sugar.
Sugar, yeah.
Followed by booze. And it was just an amazing like sort of like introductory like
experience.
Okay, what this does is put just like a good base level of alcohol in my system that I can then build on. It's like a foundation for them.
Yeah, I think the only appropriate way to drink a alcohol pop is to straw-pedo it. It would be, but I mean, there's a vanishingly rare amount of...
straw-pedoed anything for ages.
There's a vanishingly rare amount of events and scenarios currently and in the near future that will require me to straw-pedo anything. So any alcohol pop I would have now would probably not be straw-pedoed. And then you're just drinking this horribly sugary sweet drink. And it is literally just 90% sugar. Like, they're horrible.
Next time I see you,
let's
straw-pedo something. Yeah. Like, because I remember there was a point where, you know, like you'd straw-pedo a WKD and you would do it in like literally under 2 seconds.
Mm.
I remember the first time, I remember doing it in front of a fresher. Like one time, and I wasn't like showing off, but this fresher I think was like quite sheltered, and she acted like you know, if like you showed like a medieval peasant like Candy Crush or something, like she was just like, what manner of devilry, like what have you done, where's it gone? And I was just,
she
like,
was looking to burn you at the stake.
Yeah, and I was just like, well, I guess you're not studying physics then, but
sure.
It's, but you know, you used to be able to,
that's
put
such
them down
an
in, like,
Oxford
2 seconds. Yeah, I know. Right? But I was like, I wonder if you can like whether I can still put one down in like a second and a half.
Yeah,
I presume I can.
I assume it's like riding a bike. There's only one way to find out.
They do Guinness in bottles, don't they?
Yeah, but like that's just something that's not meant to be straw-pedoed.
That is honestly that would honestly feel like a fishing weight. Like hitting your stomach.
Yeah.
Like it's like that quantity of iron like going straight into your stomach. It'd
be
horrendous.
Be horrible.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. So today, we thought we'd have a look at Chelsea. Because Chelsea, look, we could have talked about Manchester United. We could have.
I didn't propose.
Horrendous
that we did.
Weekend. But we thought we'd talk about Chelsea because Chelsea, you know, we went into the season being like, oh, what are Chelsea going to be? And everyone spent the entire week, like, honestly, just hanging out of Cole Palmer's ass. Like, I just, like, I get it. And we are going to talk about him. But I still don't quite know what to make of Chelsea. And so we thought we'd take a look at the beginning of the season. See how they've started, look at their schedule, look at some of their numbers, see what optimistic like fans might have been right about, and see what reasons there are to maybe like doubt the progress they've made. So Pete, where do you want to start? Because I mean, like, obviously we're coming off the weekend where it's a big win, like it's a home win, and it was a pretty I don't know, naive Brighton side. And to be honest with you, Chelsea also were not tremendous on it. But broadly, they're where they'd hope to be at the start of the season. They're not up there with the very, very top teams, but they're right next door to them. Mm-hmm. And they've got one of the best players in the league absolutely flying. So I don't know. Do you want to kind of like sum up the...
Yeah, I was fairly down on Chelsea at the start in the off-season in the lead up to this. I was like, this is a shit show. You know, I remember the episode we did on them about their manager. We were like, does Kieran McKenna want to take like this swing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I just kind of didn't see a huge amount of success in Chelsea's future, or at least near future, immediate future. Mm-hmm. And for the top line numbers, for their, just based on results, where they are on the table, they've had a really good start of the season. I don't think they can honestly have wished, at least in terms of table position, for a better start of the season after the kind of like year they had last year and the summer they had and all the kind of upheaval and just chaos that has ensued over the past couple of seasons behind the scenes at Chelsea. So 6 games in, they won 4, drawn 1, lost 1. Mm-hmm. The one game they've lost was City in the opening day. Like, you know, if you lose to City in the Premier League, that's kind of fair. They scored the most goals in the league, 15 goals in 6 games. And if you look at all comps as well, like their attack, conversion-wise, it's absolutely purring. They put 6 past Wolves, 5 past Barrow in the League Cup, 4 past Brighton, 3 past West Ham. Cole Palmer obviously scored 4 against Brighton, and everybody, the entire nation, cradled his balls for about, what, 4 or 5 days, still probably ongoing. And yeah, I think when they're 1 or 2 points back off Liverpool, Arsenal, City, after 6 games, top line alone, I don't think they could have asked for more. They scored a lot of goals. Okay, yes, there are problems that we'll definitely come on to. And the results that they might have gotten or that they have earned might not necessarily reflect the dominance or the position that they should be in or they currently are in versus where they might should be. But in terms of just starting this section, very top line, I don't think that if you're a Chelsea fan or a Chelsea player or involved in the club, I don't think you can be annoyed in any way about how they've started the season.
No, I think that... You expect there to be difficulties early on. So if you get through the early stage of the season where you're still learning the new manager, he's still working out his, you know, his favoured players and the guys he's not going to use, and you're in touch with like the top sides.
The 45 players he's not going to use.
Yeah, exactly. Then hopefully it means that like by the time everybody starts to gel, you can actually get something interesting going. Obviously, that assumes that like there is going to be improvement. And I'm not saying that there like won't be improvement, but obviously as well, like people maybe went into the season playing a certain way against Chelsea that if Chelsea end up being really good over the course of the season, will be adjusted. So you maybe get one season where people play against you like you're not a top side. But if you start looking like a top side, teams will play more defensively against you. So that's a kind of factor. Underlying numbers, also excellent. Plus 0.85 expected goal difference per 90. That's third in the league between Liverpool, City and Tottenham. If you adjust 11 versus 11, it's behind Arsenal as well. But like, it's in that group. Mm-hmm. I'd say they're probably, in my mind right now, I'd say they're kind of like, it goes Liverpool, City and Arsenal are like in a group by themselves, those three teams.
Yeah, as expected.
Then maybe Chelsea and Tottenham are like another group by themselves. And then after that, you get like Villa, Newcastle, maybe Brighton, but probably not. Like, so I don't know, some other guys. And then you get like 10 more teams and then you get Man United.
Sure.
But like, but there aren't, it's not like there are no, I don't know about red flags, but like the performances have not all been just like incredible, right? So like the City game, okay, Chelsea's expected goal difference, I think, is helped by the fact that City played that game within themselves. Mm-hmm. Like if City had needed a goal towards the end of the match, I think that they'd have racked up XG, but they didn't need to, so they didn't. So it just wasn't an issue.
They just managed that game so well. It looks so comfortable.
Exactly. And sometimes you can just have a game like that where you're like, well, we didn't need to attack, so we didn't do anything. Like, that's quite normal. The Wolves game, Chelsea conceded more XG than they put up. They got 6 goals from 1.6 XG, which is like, you know, whatever. Bournemouth game, not only should Chelsea not have won, but they probably should have lost. And I would also look at the strength of schedule. So Their schedule ranks about the eighth easiest in the Premier League so far, according to Scott Willis on Twitter. So that's like not like the crazy, like it's just so easy. But Wolves, West Ham and Palace are all out of sorts sides, and Wolves are going to be relegation candidates. Those are wins. They're just wins. Brighton and Bournemouth are going to be competitive sides, but Brighton also are working out some kinks at the moment, and Bournemouth were better than Chelsea. City is the only truly tough game that they had. And I would also point out that the Brighton game and the City game, which are their two like toughest teams, they both played at home. So that's just like, again, it's not a huge issue, but it's just like a little thing to keep note of. Like, we are still in the stage of the season where strength of schedule can have an enormous difference. And there are some teams like Liverpool have had an incredibly easy schedule and Arsenal have had a difficult schedule. Okay, that doesn't really affect my analysis of Liverpool. I think Liverpool look incredible and are going to be incredible. And we've seen them in a tough Champions League away game. Like there are signs there that make me think Liverpool are better than this. With Chelsea, jury's still out, is how I look at it. But their schedule's been tougher than Villa, and they're level on points with Villa. Mm-hmm. And their schedule's been about the same as Spurs and Newcastle, and they're ahead of Spurs and Newcastle. So I think that broadly, this is pretty positive. And I think that if you offered Maresca this before the season, he'd have been delighted. Chelsea fans are getting quite pumped about it.
Mm.
And I get it. Especially I get it about Palmer.
Yeah. He's the interesting one. He's the interesting thing about Chelsea.
Okay. Should we talk about Palmer then? Should we just go into Palmer?
Well, yeah, we can. I think just the last thing I would have on Chelsea overall was as good as their start's been results-wise, like you said, they were kind of lucky to get a number of results, or they're kind of a little bit lucky to be in the position they are. But they, while they're scoring a ton of goals, they're also like giving up quite a lot of XG against. And I think there's only two other teams in the top half of the league currently who have a higher expected goals against tally than they do.
Really?
One of whom is Brighton, who will have conceded the majority of their XG against in that Chelsea game, which was chaos, which I'm sure we'll come on to. And the other one is Newcastle. So as good as Chelsea have been in attack, they have been a little bit leaky and flimsy in defence, at least giving up chances defensively. So I think that is a little bit of a red flag for me across the full season. But yeah, with Palmer, like it is hard not to big him up a lot, and I genuinely try not to. Like, I don't hate the guy. I'm kind of nothing.
I like how stupid he is.
Oh my god! Right, I wondered when we've come on to this, but
I genuinely like it. I'm not trying to be an arsehole.
No,
like,
you see him.
He's like, I don't know, like about a really simple question. I love it.
I'm fascinated as to how a scenario has created, whatever scenarios that happened throughout his childhood and up to now, that have created a person who is just so staggeringly unintelligent. Even for a footballer, it's impressive.
And can you imagine if City had kept him and they'd had him in a dressing room with Grealish? It would have been like it would have been like when two Furbies started talking to each other. Like, you'd have just been like, guys, we can't get into this because you're just going to be like asking each other, like, won't even say why. You'll be like, how come for the rest of your life?
I would argue that the Furbies have more sentience, but sure. But yeah, I think in many ways it actually might play into his strengths or play into his favour in that I think he's genuinely not there enough to really think and comprehend about the scenarios that he puts himself in.
So like, he doesn't feel pressure. He does,
the amount of pressure. Like, just, I think, because you always see like a lot of people talk about like football IQ and stuff and like the more intelligent players in the game. I can see those players mulling over decisions they've made or things that are coming up. I think they'll be in their heads a lot more, trying to analyse it and how they kind of better themselves. I think Cole Palmer's literally just like kid on the playground. He's just like recess happens, he just runs until he's told to go back home. Like, that's just it. He just goes and runs, plays football. He's just like, he's like a wind-up bunny. Just like, set him and goes until he gets told to stop. And that's just Cole Palmer's life. And I think in many ways, like, I think in terms of pressure, in terms of performance, overthinking is a really, really common factor in poor performance or in why you have like downturns, why you're not playing the way you know you can play. If Palmer is not capable of reaching that level of, I guess, thought process, then that's a huge plus. But yeah, we were. I didn't know we were going to go this deep into his lack of intelligence.
But yeah, it's like if you took all the apps off your phone would never overheat.
Sure.
And I feel like that's kind of what Cole Palmer has done.
It would
mentally.
Run so fast as well, because like no memory would be used.
So Cole Palmer has taken all the general knowledge and stuff off his phone, his mental hard drive. Yeah. As a result, his mental hard drive is literally just like, here is ball, pass ball, score goal.
He's got one app on his phone and his Flappy Bird, and that's it. That's all he needs. But yeah, I mean, look, undoubtedly he has been incredible, not just this season, but last. Like, he was a flavour of the year last season. 22 goals, 11 assists in the Premier League, 9 penalties, but sure, it's a very, very impressive return. Won the Young Player of the Year, and he's brought that form into this season too. He's got 6 goals and 4 assists in 6 games, which also 500 minutes. So he's registering a goal involvement every 50 minutes this season so far. Obviously pretty a very good. Small sample size, but that is staggeringly good. He's got the same amount of goal involvements as Haaland, but Palmer's played less minutes, so he is the most lethal entity in the Premier League right now. Or it could be the world. And yeah, like, his game against Brighton was fantastic. It was great. Like, the free kick was fantastic. The penalty was a penalty. The fourth goal was decent, and the first goal was, like, kind of lucky.
An open goal. Like, Jackson squares it to him, and it's an open goal. Like, I was talking about it today with, like, Zach, and I was like, it's amazing. Like, to score 4 goals is amazing. And, like, I'm not taking anything away from it. But, like, one of them's a penalty, and one of them's an open goal.
Yeah.
Like, I kind of chalk the penalty off.
Free kick is fantastic.
But in a way, like the last goal, the free kick, and then the creative passing is, to me, what's impressive.
Yeah.
Like, it's not just like, he scored 4 goals. It does feel like everyone's like, now he scored 4 goals in a game, we're going insane. And I'm kind of like, one of those goals is a penalty and one of those goals is an open goal. Like, we should be talking about him the way we were talking about him a week ago, where he was also amazing. You know?
The last goal is a near post goal that you could argue the keeper should have done better. What's more impressive is his movement there.
It's a pretty amazing finish, though.
It's a good finish, but I think what's more impressive is his movement in that space.
I agree.
It just shows, it's the kind of movement that you just see that, mate, he looks so effortless doing it, and it's almost like second nature, and it looks like it's the kind of thing you see from like a really, really top level finisher, like really top level like goal scorer. And yeah, like it goes without saying that he has had a fantastic year, and he's continuing that on now, and he's rightly being put up with like the kind of best goal scorers in the league currently, you know, your Haalands, your Salahs. And in fairness to him, he actually has surpassed them since the start of last season. He's got more goal involvement than anybody else in the Premier League. He's got one more goal involvement than Haaland. He's got like 7 more, I think, than Salah. Since the start of last season, Cole Palmer is averaging 1.2 goal involvement per 90. So that sample size is an available game of, what, 44 games. He's averaging across a 44-game period. He won't have played all those games, but across a 44-game period.
I mean, I would
period,
take the pens out, but sure.
But also, the thing is, when you're comparing him against Haaland and Salah, both of whom also take pens.
No, I take the pens out for everyone, yeah.
Sure, yeah, but 1.2 goal involvements per 90 is better than both of them, who also take pens. And if you look at them without the penalties, this is where he starts to come back down to earth. He is ahead of Haaland and Salah in terms of goal involvements and goal involvements per 90 across the last season and the 6 games that have started already. But when you look at non-penalty expected goal involvements, Haaland and Salah are like 33. Palmer's like down at 28. So Palmer's goal involvements in that time period are 43. I think Haaland's got 42 and Salah's got 36.
If and you look 10 at of 10 9, of Palmer's are pens.
10, yeah, 10 considering the one against Brighton.
So he's got 33 from 28 is what we're looking at here.
For non-penalty expected goal involvements.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
And
okay. So he's a pretty significant that's like a Messi sized overperformance.
Sure.
So we'd expect that to come back down. I mean, it's still pretty outstanding. But.
Yeah, and the players he's been kind of compared against in terms of like the truly, truly elite finishers and creators in the league, Haaland and Salah, they are far less out over their skis. So it goes without saying that Palmer has been great. I'm not denying that in any sense or for any second. He just is a little bit out over skis. I still think he will be very, very good across the season. I just feel like he will take a little bit of a step back. And a little bit of a step back is him kind of going to maybe like 0.7 goal involvements per 90, 0.8 from 1.2, which is still very, very good. I'm interested to see how Chelsea perform if and when Cole Palmer's output just slows a little bit.
So to put that in context, you know, if he's at 28 non-penalty expected goal involvements since the start of last season, Saka's at like 25.4.
Mm-hmm.
So he's kind of closer to Saka there than he is to
Salah.
To Salah and Haaland.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, that's still a pretty good place to be.
But
it's not like, but when people are like, is he the best player in the league now? You're kind of like, well,
pump the brakes
like,
a little bit.
He's in a group of players who have been exceptionally good. I imagine that Ollie Watkins is actually kind of in that in that group as well. Yeah, that'll be interesting when that comes down, because Jackson has also been phenomenal. And yeah, he and Palmer together get really, really, really high quality shots. Really high quality shots. Mm-hmm. So they have by far the best shot quality in the league, about 0.16 expected goals per shot. And that's league average is about, a league average is like 0.11, right? So it's about 1.5 times the quality of the average shot in the league. Shot volume is quite low though. So like 12 shots a game. So that might be okay. They may just be like that. It might be that even against the best sides in the world, Jackson's runs are so good and Palmer's creativity is so good and his runs that they can continue to get these really, really high value chances. But they might not be able to. And the question then will be, can they pile on enough volume to create against the superior sides, you know, the sides that are going to track those runs, the sides that are better at closing the space. So against Van Dijk, against Saliba, against Ruben Dias, like against like elite Champions League teams, will they be able to to get the separation that they have been able to so far this season? Because to me, a lot of that shot quality looks like we've played some shit teams.
Who's chosen not to play midfield?
Yes, exactly. So that would be kind of an interesting thing to keep an eye on, I guess. And there's the other factor, which is like, who else is in this attacking lineup? Like, they've got loads and loads and loads of options, but I don't really know who they want to be using. And we're going to come on to something in a bit when we talk, I guess, a bit more about Maresca and talk about the defense, but I have question marks there too, which kind of stem from the attack. So it's all very well with like Jackson flying and like Palmer being amazing, but Maresca's got an awful lot of guys who are going to be clamoring for minutes, right?
Yeah, this and is
I just don't know how you manage it.
You can't. This is impossible. Like, he is put in a completely impossible position. So, like, basically, if you look at their front four, Palmer is obviously going to be nailed on. Like, absolutely nailed on. Palmer will be on the pitch for as long as is humanly possible and is safe for him to be on the pitch. Like they will run him into the ground as they can. And I think that's completely fair. He's one of the best players in the league on current form. So that means that the rest of their attacking stable are competing for three spots. And that attacking stable consists of Jackson, who's also three probably going to be... Jackson's also probably going to be nailed on starting for a similar amount as Palmer. Nkunku, Joao Felix, Pedro Neto, Jadon Sancho, Mikhail Mudryk, Noni Madueke, and Mark Gay. That's eight players for probably 2.5 spots if you take into the fact that Jackson is also fairly nailed on, is going to be playing the vast majority of the minutes available. And that is, one, very, very difficult to manage at the best of times. But these players are not like breakthrough players. These players aren't like 17-year-olds coming through the academy. These players are like notable players who either have come with like a certain amount of notoriety or have come at a significant fee. You know, Jadon Sancho and Joao Felix, household names, who have come to really try and like reignite their studying careers. Neto is just looking to play more than 1,000 minutes without his leg falling off. Very keen to get in the pitch. Mudryk arrived for 90 million almost in January 2023. And Nkunku was over 50 million. Like, that's already five big players there for 2.5 spots. A lot of money invested, a lot of money in wages, and also big players who have, there's an element of ego amongst them as well. All of these players are legitimate, at least they think in themselves that they are top level players, and they will come with the ego, and they will come with the expectation of being, I am going to be the starting left winger, or I am going to be starting on the right wing, and you know, all the other players are going to be behind me, and that's fine. Like, I'm good enough. I should be starting. And when you have eight players and 2.5 spots to fill, or seven players if you take out Jackson, 2.5 spots to fill, that is just an impossible task. It's an impossible task, because even with domestic competitions and European football, like, there are just not enough minutes in a league season to satisfy all of those players in terms of pitch time across a season. And for me, that just leads to a lot of infighting, a lot of, you know, like, kind of players in the dressing room turning against each other, turning against the manager, kind of souring relationships, a lot of frustration, a lot of annoyance, and just not a very unified entity. You're not a very unified squad. And it feels like Maresca is just going to spend the entire season trying to keep this house of cards from tumbling down. Like, it genuinely feels like he's going to spend, we've not even come on to midfield or defence, where they're also arguably oversubscribed in places as well. It feels like Maresca is just going to spend his entire season just stopping, like putting out fires everywhere and trying to stop the inmates from taking over the asylum. Like, that's what it feels like. And it just doesn't feel like this Chelsea squad, as bloated and as expensive as it is, can go through a season without any significant, like, big fallouts. So big bus stops, whatever, like big dressing room issues. It's just, in my opinion, it's not possible.
Yeah, it feels like at the very least, you'd need somebody at the club who was kind of a peacemaker. You know, so for example, in the Abramovich days, you can imagine Abramovich like takes a couple of these guys aside, mm-hmm. if they are kicking up a fuss about not playing, and he's just like, you need to stop doing this, we'll figure something out for you, you know, like whatever it might be, whether it's like, I don't know, different money or like or a loan move or something, you know, but we're going to work something out for you. Like, you need a figure like that who could do it at the club, because Maresca is basically just going to be like, I don't want these guys. Mudrik is not going to play unless he absolutely has to. Like, right now, I literally don't know who'll be the first choice. Like, maybe it'll be Sancho. We could easily get to Christmas and, like, Joao Felix has played, like, 300 minutes. And he's not, like, a loan that Chelsea can just send back. Like, he's a player they've bought now.
And Nkunku as well, like...
Everybody says, oh, well, you've got minutes in, like, the cup competitions or whatever. Like, why would Nkunku accept that? Nkunku's played in the Champions League with Leipzig. Joao Felix was at Barcelona last year. Like, these guys have not come there so they can play Barrow in the cup.
Yeah.
They've come there to play real football. And it doesn't matter whether they're getting minutes. If towards, like, the middle of the season, all they've done is play pub sides, like, on like Welsh cabbage patches, they are going to start to get annoyed. Mm. And Maresca does not have the stature to deal with it. Like, it just feels like there's like a squad's worth of players who they're just not going to use. And yeah, I don't know. Like, maybe you can keep everybody. It's a very hard context in which to build a kind of team ethos, like a playing style, you know, a sense of togetherness. It's really going to be really, really hard to do that when the players who are in the first team go into the dressing room with a bunch of guys who are like, I never play under this manager. He never gives me a chance. This is bullshit. And there aren't two of those guys or five of those guys. There are 20 of those guys. Like, it's a really difficult situation. So I don't know. I don't know what Chelsea do about that.
They were also reporting last year that there were so many players in the squad that they couldn't even fit in the same dressing room at Cobham. And the squad is now bigger than that. So that issue obviously still exists. So like the segregation within the squad, I think it'll be staggering. And yeah, I fully agree. I just don't think that there's any... There's just no way I look at this squad. I'm not sure of the exact number now, but in the summer it was 43 was the number that was being touted. The biggest squad in the league. There's no way that this squad is going to be unified. It's going to be like a cohesive entity, all pulling in the same direction. And for me, that's a huge, huge red flag. And this is a new manager with no... You know, with a lot less authority, I suppose, than if it was a manager who had been there for...
Yeah, he doesn't have any clout. Like,
and
he's not...
You mentioned
like Ancelotti.
Yeah, and you mentioned like the Abramovich era. Also in that time, in terms of like the Abramovich and stuff, like appeasing disgruntled players, that certainly earlier in that era, there was also like a John Terry, a Frank Lampard, like big, big club legends who could help appease that and be like, right, look, I've been here for you. If a John Terry sits you down and you're like a 22-year-old kid and you've been like getting pissed off that you're not getting minutes at right wing, and John Terry sits you down and like gives you a word, you likelihood is you probably listen. Or at least it would help a bit. Chelsea don't have those players now. You know, they got Reece James, who's never on the pitch.
Right?
Then you got Ben Chilwell, never on the pitch. Then you got what, Enzo?
And who's just not a senior player. Like, there's nobody else who's a senior player. Like, their midfield, they're all junior players. Their backline, they're like relatively junior players. But even though they're a bit older, they're like new to Chelsea. And they're not like, I'm a nailed on start. Like, if Axel Disasi was like amazing and played every minute, like, because he was amazing, then he'd have a leg to stand on, you know, like people might actually respect him.
Mm-hmm.
But otherwise you're in a situation here where you're like, who are the nailed on starters in this team? And who has any authority? Like, basically nobody. They sold all their academy guys. Like, you know, Gallagher's gone, Chalobah's gone. They've still got Colwell, but like Colwell's far too young to really be a guy that everyone's like paying attention to. So yeah, I just think like they need one, they need like a Thiago Silva in there. Who can figure this out? But I mean, look, these are all soft factors, stuff that we don't really know about. But it does mean that if Chelsea go on a bad run this season, that's a problem for them. And of course, going forward at the end of the season, what we don't know is if Chelsea get to the end of the year and they're like, you know what we could really use? We could use this profile in the squad that we're lacking.
Mm-hmm.
We have literally no idea whether they'll be able to go and do it. Like, in order to do it, they'd have to shift not just one player, but with a massive squad, they have to shift like five guys in order that they could go and get... Say they were like, next summer, they were like, oh, you know, we actually really want a... I don't even know. I genuinely don't know what the position would be. But they went out and bought so many keepers this summer. They've got so many forwards, and I know they wanted Osimhen as well, but like this idea that they can just buy all the players they want and all it is a financial problem that they've got to figure out is simply not true. It mm-hmm. will become a problem because at a certain stage, they won't be able to shift these guys and they're all on 100k a week minimum.
And they're all declining in price because in value because none of them are playing.
What's Mudryk worth now?
Half of what he was at best.
Max.
I think he was 88 and a half when he came. Like if you get 45 million for him, I think you're doing very well.
I think like I think 30 mil would be good for him.
Mm, fair, yeah.
He hasn't played. And every time he's played, he's been crap.
Yeah,
I just don't get it. But anyway, okay, so Maresca then. I find it quite hard to like really assess like what Maresca's doing. Because to be honest, when I watch Chelsea, it feels like the good stuff they do is often just great players doing great stuff. As opposed to like, oh, I see the pattern of movement here that was designed to pull a defence out of shape. What I see is like Cole Palmer plays an insane pass. Or they're playing against such incompetent pressing sides that it's just really easy. Well, do you want to talk about that?
Well, I mean, I don't mind. It's just like, so Maresca coming in, we kind of knew exactly what he was and what he was trying to do. Like we saw at Leicester, like high possession, plays out from the back, involves fullbacks into the defend against transition. And we've seen some of the execution of that, but it's been incredibly, incredibly inconsistent. And generally when we've seen it, it's like you say, it's been against teams that have been either non-existent in the press or entirely reckless in their press. And I think the Brighton game was very telling of that, in that Brighton pretty much committed to a ridiculously aggressive press with like five or six players, pushing them up into Chelsea's defensive third, and then left like a back four to defend transition. And that was really interesting, because when Chelsea couldn't get through it, Chelsea looked really, really sloppy. Like the two goals they gave up were really sloppy.
They're both embarrassing.
Yeah, like both trying to play it from the back really poorly. Sanchez has to take a lot of blame for both of them. And like this is a Brighton team kind of just going recklessly hard. And if Maresca's system was good, you would expect them to be able to completely manage that fine. Like, and not completely shit the bed twice. And that's concerning for when they come up against a team that it maybe has a better press and a more controlled but effective press. On the occasions when they did break through the first line of press, then they were just had like effectively a complete overload in attack. And that was why there were so many goals. It was like basketball. It was just completely transitional, completely end-to-end. So the biggest takeaway, while Chelsea scored four goals in the first half, that game was chaos. That made me more concerned about how they are under pressure than it did before the game. Because Brighton's press wasn't great. It was just aggressive.
Mm.
And Chelsea, you saw how quickly the cracks started to show. And then when they did finally get through it, Brighton were so out of position that it was like, okay, it's basically like a training exercise now. We're doing like overload and transition. And you play two passes and you were at the edge of the box. Like there was no surprise that there was a lot of goals for Chelsea in that game. I thought they were better against West Ham. West Ham's midfield really, really struggled in that game. It was almost non-existent. But
West Ham are worse.
Sure.
And way worse at pressing as well. Like their press was so easy to play through.
Yeah.
That I was like, do Chelsea have a plan to play through this? Or do Chelsea just have the quality to play through like such a ramshackle press?
It was different in the fact that Brighton were far more aggressive, and that's what Chelsea struggled with. With West Ham, I think Cucurella's role, when he inverted in and they overloaded that midfield area, West Ham just didn't react to that at all. And Chelsea just had two passes available every time through the middle. It was so easy and pedestrian for them to progress the ball through the middle in that West Ham game. And I think they were fairly deserved winners in that game. But those are two teams who we've just said have either implemented a shit press or a ridiculously mental press, neither of which will happen against a genuinely good team. And this is where the real kind of like separates the wheat from the chaff, in that, okay, it's all well and good being like we comfortably played through West Ham. We made their press look like it was non-existent. Or we scored four goals in the first half against Brighton, but, you know, just forget about the two goals that we fucking put up for them on a platter because of their like mental press. Good teams. Teams like Arsenal, teams like City, teams like Liverpool, they'll come with a press that is not as aggressive as Brighton's, but it'll feel as aggressive because they're doing it more efficiently and they're not being pulled out of position as much.
Yeah, Bournemouth did it.
Yeah, fair point. And, yeah, and Bournemouth should have won that game.
Side. Like, Bournemouth pressed them really aggressively, and it was highly effective. It limited Chelsea to, like, 0.6 XG.
Yeah, and they had, like, 1.9 like XG.
Yeah, 1.7, 1.9, yeah. Something like that. Like, they were comfortably better, and that might be what this looks like. Yeah, okay, so I have this same question. So, what can they do against a side that presses and isn't wide open? Yes. But also, what can they do against a team which holds the ball and just tells them to come and get it? Because they're not an effective pressing side at all. So by passes per defensive action, they rank as the 14th most aggressive in the league. So they don't really press super high. They don't limit teams getting in the danger zone. So if you look at something called opposition deep completions, so that's the number of opponent passes completed within 20 meters of your goal, they're 12th in the league for that. Mm-hmm. And that's quite a good proxy for danger allowed, right? It's like, sure, how much can teams pass it about, like, close
on the
to
edge
goal
of a box, yeah.
And they rank below Everton and Man United for that. And they've played a very easy schedule. That's interesting. I also think that in some squads, I'd look at that and I'd think, well, the press will improve over time. It'll get more coherent. These players know how to do it. Like, they'll understand what the manager wants, and it'll get better. But I look at Chelsea and I look at Chelsea and I'm like, the one doubt about Palmer, Ted Knutson said this to me the other day. He was like, if Cole Palmer actually wants to be one of the best forwards in the world, he's going to need to learn to, like, press really effectively. Because, mm-hmm, like, you know, Salah, Saka, like, those guys, like, they press, Vinicius, yeah, they press really effectively. So, can Palmer press is one question. But can Jackson press? Can Madueke press? Will Felix press? Will all these guys do enough defending to stop the midfield and the back line getting overrun? Because the midfield still gets overrun pretty easily. That's interesting. They're second bottom in the league for defensive actions in the final third. Arsenal have spent a sixth of the season down a man, mm-hmm, and have got a lot of shit for, like, playing conservatively and sitting deep. They're fifth from top for, mm-hmm, defensive actions in the final third. They're way more proactive in trying to win the ball back there than Chelsea are.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you look at possession in their games, they've had over 60% possession in all their games except against City, West Ham and Brighton, where they had under 50% in all of them. Now, West Ham and Brighton, it's easy. They went up goals early against West Ham. And against Brighton, they were happy to do it because Brighton were just really naive and pushing on to them. Mm-hmm. And they were able to play through the press. But City, which is the one game where they played a team which both wanted the ball and could cover when Chelsea played through, they lost. So what happens? And against Brighton as well, let's be clear, like, they gave up two terrible goals. And if Cole Palmer doesn't put, like, a world-class free kick in the top corner, like, that game's within a goal. It could have been much closer.
Yeah.
Now, I don't think that would have been fair. I do think they were comfortably the better side overall. But still, there was a huge amount of danger given up to a team that was playing in a way that kind of suits Chelsea. Mm-hmm. Against City, they couldn't really do much of anything. So if I were playing against Chelsea and I was a really good side, my plan would be press high and we just watch Jackson, or we park someone on Palmer, and that's what we do.
Mm-hmm.
That's the dangerous connection, Palmer to Jackson.
Yeah.
So if I'm like Liverpool, I'm like, we're going to press the fuck out of these guys and we're going to park Konate on Jackson.
Yeah.
And we're going to tell, like, McAllister or whatever to just, like, give Palmer a miserable day.
And you're basically going to say, like, Nuni Madueke, do something.
And yeah, he's going to run down, see what they can do. Every time. See what they can do. But if I were a smaller team, you know, like, not at that level, without those, like, quality centre backs, basically, or, you know, elite defensive midfielders. If I were a smaller team, I'd be like, let's hold the ball, let's play it around, let's play, like, defensive possession, not, like, right in front of our goal in our box, but let's play the ball around in our own third. Let's have a mid block with only a couple of guys staying high. Let's not, like, overcommit, and let's see what Chelsea do.
Mm-hmm.
Can they come and press us? Can they take the ball off us? If we have the passing quality of, like, I don't know who a good example would be here. A lot of these teams are kind of too good now. But even a shit team like Southampton. Southampton are dreadful.
Mm.
But they can pass the ball around. So if they just keep the ball, pass it around, what can Chelsea do about that? Can they pull them out of a mid block? Can they go and win the ball back? I just honestly don't know that they can. Like, they might be able to, but right now they're not really giving signs of being able to do it. So what Chelsea want at the moment is either for a team to say, you have all the ball, and you just, like, do what you want when you want and, like, try and play through us. And Chelsea are like, okay, we've got Cole Palmer, we'll do that. Or teams are coming and pressing Chelsea, and Chelsea do just have, like, the skill to play through them because the presses are not really dialed in very much.
Yeah.
So Chelsea being good looks like the team getting better at pressing and they continue to play through presses. They get better at playing through presses, and they develop a good press of their own. And it means that when they're playing like Brentford or whoever, and that team's keeping the ball, Chelsea go and like rip the ball off them, and they're onto the back line immediately, and they're creating huge chances. Chelsea being bad, and I don't think they'll be bad, but Chelsea being like not great, probably looks like teams holding the ball against Chelsea, Chelsea can't get it off them.
Mm-hmm.
Teams pressing coherently against Chelsea, and Chelsea just can't play out very well, and they give up.
Yeah.
Like big chances. Like the Bournemouth game. The Bournemouth game is the vision of like what this Chelsea side looks like if they can't develop that side of their game.
And if they and do play out, the opposition's good enough to just suppress that transition enough to get back in and stop like a full-on transition, big chance.
Yeah, and that's Bournemouth. Bournemouth. Like Bournemouth did that with like sub-elite talent, I think that's fair to say.
Yeah.
But I'd be looking, if I had Chelsea coming up in like a few games' time, I'd be like, these are my two game plans. If I've got really, really like athletic centre-backs, I think, right, we're going to press them, we're going to scare them, and then we're going to like rely on our centre-backs to mop stuff up. Yeah. And if I didn't have that, I'd be like, we're going to pass it around the back, we're going to wait till they push up on us, and then we're just going to play through them. Because you know what? As good as their forwards are, and actually as good as their individuals are,
yeah,
I think we can just pass through their midfield. I think their midfield is weak.
Do you genuinely see a world where this current stable of Chelsea forwards are turned into a top, or at least a completely respectable Premier League pressing side? Because I personally don't, because the names I listed off earlier, Jackson and Nkunku, Felix, Pedronato, Sancho, Midrick, etc. Who of them has a notable defensive output historically?
Nkunku.
Sure. Okay, one of eight. One of nine.
So your best scenario is that Palmer becomes a great presser and you play like Nkunku. Because so I don't think Sancho
you'll press well
can do
against
it.
Barrow when he's on.
Fair point. but you know, like Jackson I think will do it. So if you ended up with Nkunku, Jackson and Palmer, and then maybe what you do is just drop a forward and play another midfielder.
I don't think Nkunku's gonna play. Madueke, I think, is favoured at the minute. Nkunku's getting like 10 minutes a game in the Premier League. That might change, but if you say Jackson can become a respectable defensive output for Ford, Palmer, despite having just chippy chips in his head, might be able to learn how to become
chippy chips.
A respectable central attacking midfield presence in a press. The issues for me are right wide, like with your likes of Sancho, Felix, Neto, Madueke. I don't see any of them, historically at least, wanting to press enough, having the desire to put in the defensive work. They just want the ball in transition and get to do something with it. Like those are the types of players I feel they are. And I'm not sure how Chelsea can manage that and manufacture that into a coherent, cohesive, effective press.
I agree. So I think that then potentially the solution is that you don't play a front four. What you do is you play like Palmer, Jackson and Nkunku, something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then your midfield becomes something like Caicedo, Enzo, and then maybe like Kani Chukwuemeka or something.
Mm-hmm.
Or Lavia. You know, like that kind of thing.
So Maresca would have to depart from like his system then?
I don't think that's true. Like, I don't think a system is the same as like a formation. And I think that like, you know, he bought Kean and Dewsbury Hall. Like, these are guys...
I still find that so fucking dumb.
And it's so stupid. But like, but that might be the thing though. Like right now we look at it and we're like, well, you can't bench this guy. You can't bench that guy. But if this proves to be a problem over the course of the season, I think you could easily... That front three is really, really good.
Yeah,
and then... And also, if you put Kani or Romeo Lavia, who I thought was good, you know, opening day of the season, if you put those guys in there with Caicedo and Enzo, the midfield is harder to press through, harder to pass through. And then I worry much, much less about that front line, because then potentially Palmer might be the only kind of passenger. And that doesn't matter too much because of the strength you've got everywhere else. That might be the way to do it. Obviously, that presents other problems, because then you're going to have to say to, like, Felix, Sancho, I don't know, who else is there? Madueke, Mudrik, like, all these guys.
We haven't even mentioned Marquet.
Yeah, sorry, you're never gonna play football for us ever again.
Yeah.
Like, but that honestly might end up in the most coherent Chelsea side. So if I were Maresca, I mean, I don't think that anymore you have to pick like your best team and then you roll them out every week, but no. I wouldn't be surprised if come the end of the season, either Chelsea's press still looks pretty ropey, or he's had to pick somebody who on raw talent alone is inferior to the guy they're replacing, but makes more sense tactically. Because Kani is not as good as Joao Felix. As much as I like Carney or Lavia, they are not as good as Joao Felix. They are not as good as Jadon Sancho or Noni Madueke, but they might make your team not look like an absolute basket case, like in the press.
It's very rare that the collective is outweighed by the individual. Like, you have to be a staggeringly good player to outweigh a collective like decision that betters the entire team as a system.
Yeah, yeah.
And Palmer's probably the only player who's on current form, maybe Jackson, is good enough or showing that they're good enough to maybe be like, okay, we'll sacrifice the system to keep you on the pitch. No other player in that squad's good enough to merit that.
I think you get one and maybe under exceptional circumstances, a second luxury player. Yeah. Like, if you have those, if you have more than one, you better have, like, Rodri in your team.
Where everything absolutely fucking locked down.
Yeah, you better be like Real Madrid, where you're like, okay, so Mbappe's not going to do anything, and maybe Vinicius won't do anything, or maybe Bellingham won't do anything, but on the plus side, Bellingham can do something, but yeah. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
On the plus side, you're like, okay, right, we're going to play Tchouaméni, Valverde, and Camavinga, and they're just going to kill everything that moves. Yeah. Like, that is kind of what you need. It's the same as an issue we've talked about with Manchester City, which is like, if Manchester City try and roll out, like, Grealish, an elderly Gundogan, Foden and Haaland at the same time, how effectively does that team press you? Because in the Arsenal game, there were quite a lot of times. In that first half, before the red card, Arsenal really got back into the game and I thought were pretty impressive, like the way they grew back into it. They got the equaliser out of nowhere, but then they really grew back into the game. There were a couple of times in there where Saliba gets on the ball and Haaland goes to press him and Saliba just skips away from him and then just runs into midfield and plays a free pass through the lines. And I was just like, that's Manchester City. That's Manchester City. And Haaland, you know, like, kind of justifies being that sort of luxury player. And so does Cole Palmer. But when you're playing more than one of them,
yeah,
you better know what your trade-off is. And so it's an interesting question. And like, I think Chelsea have had a good start to the season. I think they'll be pretty good this season. They might even be like really good. But for them to be really good, they need to show something they haven't shown us so far. And I think, you know, let's hope they don't. Let's hope they're crap and that it all falls apart. So that brings us to the burn book. Pete, do you want to start? Do you want to go first or second? Do you want to go positive or negative?
I can go second, but let's go. Okay. Let's go positive first.
Okay. All right. So I'm calling this one a bit early because I haven't actually used this yet, but what I'm taking out of the burn book is personalized skincare.
Okay.
So there are subscription services, and I've just signed up for one, where you basically say, here are my skincare concerns. Mm-hmm. And they do a whole questionnaire and you send them pictures and all this shit. And then they create like a little elixir, you know, like a little serum that you use every day that is specifically targeted to deal with the problems you have. So, for example, if you have like dry skin or redness, if you have acne, if whatever it is, like, we have specialized ingredients that we can use. And this is a prescription service as well. So these are like active ingredients, like retinols and acids and stuff. Like, yeah, they go down to like Snape's dungeon.
Yeah.
And they put some shit in a jar. They put a Bezoar in a jar.
Polyjuice potion shit, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. They polyjuice potion you into a much hotter person.
Yeah, into a person with better skin.
Exactly. It's you, but with better skin. Yeah, so they fucking go through all this rigmarole.
Mm-hmm.
But I know quite a lot about skincare.
Yeah.
And still, I'm like, well, I can solve certain problems with skincare. I know which ones work for me in X regard or Y regard. But I was like, you know what? I've never actually try to address specifically sort of like my problems, you know, as in like sometimes you're like your skin's a bit dry, so you put on moisturizer. Like, I put on moisturizer every day, but you know, like, it's never occurred to me that like, oh, I have, it's occurred to me, but I've never thought to go and get a personalized regimen based on like my specific skin type. And I think for a lot of people, while it sounds very involved to go to a service like this that like gives you all these like specialized active ingredients rather than just, you know, buying like Bulldog moisturizer and using that, I think actually this is an easier entry point, because for a lot of people, if they start looking at skincare, I had a friend text me the other day, like a man text me and say like, what do I need to put on my skin? Because he knows I'm interested in it. And I was kind of like, I know what you look like, but like, I don't know what your skin concerns are, man. And I just think that like, that is a really, really difficult like barrier to get past. You can find yourself reading about this shit forever. And there are things that people will say, you know, like, oh, how do you feel about your skin texture? And like, if even I, as somebody who like has an interest in skincare, I'm kind of like, what do you mean by that? Like, sometimes I'm just like, I don't really know what you mean by that. Like, my skin texture, like, I feel like texture is determined by things like dryness or oiliness, but like, it means other things as well. It's like, do you have rosacea? Like, do you have like any kind of redness that you don't like? Like, all these sorts of things. So having a service like this, where you answer these questions the best of your ability, and then they take pictures, and then they send you this thing, which also, by the way, like, they give you a month supply, and then each month they send you another kind of like carton of it, and they gradually increase the active ingredients that way, so that you're like eased into it.
Like a drug addict.
I think, yeah, exactly, like a drug addict. So they're just like, here, we start you on like, you know, the small dose of
fentanyl,
of OxyContin, and then like by the end you're on the 160s. I think that that's actually a really good way for most people to do it. I think most people, they think, I do not want to spend hours working out what I need to put on my skin. Just give me like, here are two or three things and you do these three things.
Yeah.
And to some people, that would just be too much. But for other people, they'd be like, if you give it to me and just tell me to do these and I notice myself looking better, then I'll do it.
It's essentially and like going to PT for your skin.
Yes, it is. It's just, you do a quick consultation, you send them pictures, and they send you this stuff. So obviously, look, it might be crap. I might say to you next month, like, I hate this, and it's not working for me. But even then, you can get in touch with them and say, I think that this is, you know, doing this, it's making my skin dry, or it's giving me, like, acne or whatever, and they can adjust it. But, like, it does seem to me like this is an easy place for skincare to go, especially for men who tend to be less knowledgeable about, less interested in the kind of in the ins and outs of skincare. They don't want to hear about like niacinamide. Like, people who are not interested in this stuff do not want to be told about like niacinamide and azelaic acid and retinols or whatever. They just want somebody to give you something and be like, you know how your skin gets like red around your nose? It won't be if you use this. You know how I don't know, you get acne on your cheeks? Like, this will stop that. That's what they want. And so I just think it's like a really good idea and a good way to cater to people individually, because otherwise we're all in a position where you're like, if you looked for skincare online, if you looked for recommendations, you'd find that there was the stuff that had the, you tend to go for the stuff that has the most recommendations, right? When you buy something on like Amazon or whatever, you're funneled towards the stuff that most people have bought and most people have used and people have rated highly. But with skincare, that means that like, okay, they might send you to buy like this skin cream from like Nivea.
It's always Bulldog.
Sure. And it's like tens of thousands of people have used it. But what that means is that a lot of people who maybe do not have specialized needs are using that and find it to be, you know, somewhat good. You never know how much they love it because you don't know what their kind of expectation is. But probably the people who love it are the people who don't have specialized needs. Whereas if you do have a specialized need, or maybe if you're just, you know, like more particular about your skin, because some people are like, well, my skin doesn't feel dry and tight, so that'll do. If you do have those more specialized needs, or you do have like a different standard or some specific thing you want to address with your skin, then being funneled towards the stuff that like the people that like, you know, the majority of people have found useful is actually the worst place for you to go. Like, what you really want is to drill down on your specific problems and get those addressed. So I'm quite positive about this as an idea, even if I don't end up liking the company. I'm not going to say the name of the company because I don't want to promote them when they're not paying me any money. And also because I can't give you an honest review of them yet. But I like this idea, and I think it's a good accessible way to get people into skincare.
I'm looking forward to the next episode being sponsored by them.
If only.
Okay, so that was out.
That was out.
What am I taking out? What I'm taking out are Ring doorbells. So these are obviously like the video recording doorbells. And I'm surprised it's taken me this long to take this out of the Burnbrook, because we got one a few years after we moved into our house. And let me tell you, it is genuinely, for me, has been life-changing. And that is not even a little bit of an exaggeration. So I'm a real curtain twitcher in the house. For people who don't know what curtain twitching means, essentially it's like the person who stands by their window behind the curtains just peering out into the street whenever they hear something, whenever they hear commotion, whenever they hear noise.
Emma is a curtain twitcher.
I am a huge curtain twitcher. So I've always been very, very interested in the happenings that happen in the immediate area outside my house. And for the first few years, that was fine. That was normal. It was just like I would be lying in bed, I would hear a noise, and I'd be like, oh, what's that? I would get up and I would peer out the window and I would see someone. And either they might be getting out of the car and they'd be like, oh, who's that? Oh, that's that person who lives in that house. Right, okay, yeah, yeah. You would slowly build up like a catalogue of information about the people comings and goings in the street. But you're limited in that sense because you're only doing it for a handful of minutes whenever you hear something and whenever you're in the house and in the room. And it got to the stage where I was just like, I think it was like a Black Friday or something a couple of years ago. Ring doorbells were like 40%, 50% discounted. I was like, fuck it, let's buy one. Let's get one. Put it up. And I'm not kidding you. I reckon my most watched TV show is the Ring doorbell. Like my video hours watched on video, I genuinely think it competes with like Netflix and stuff. On one level, it makes curtain twitching much more accessible. So I can be lying in bed and hear something outside. I no longer need to get up, or it's very rare that I need to get up and actually go to the window. I can just open my phone and have like a panoramic view outside my front door so I can see what's happening. So straight away, ease of access. Also can do that from anywhere in the world. I'm able to live a more sedentary life. Which is the biggest goal in life for me, at least. I don't need to get up in the middle of the night to look out the window. I can do it from my bed. But also, what's really interesting is that because it records motion whenever it sees motion, the like patterns you see emerging about your neighbours and what you start to learn about them, which you didn't know before, is quite staggering. And it genuinely kind of turns into like a bit of like a pseudo soap opera. Just kind of being like, you just see narratives develop and consistencies and trends develop that you would have never known before. And whether that's relevant or not, whether that's beneficial to know or not, is largely irrelevant for me, but I enjoy it. And then also we've recently put one out the back. So we've got not the doorbell, but like the camera out the back. And that was primarily for the cat, because the cat is an idiot and gets lost and gets, well, it doesn't get lost, but gets stuck places. But yeah, Ring doorbells, the whole ecosystem of Ring, big fan, spent a lot of time watching it. One of the guys I work with has his whole house internally set up with Ring cameras. I draw the line significantly before that.
That's too much.
It's way too much. So there is a limit to me. It's external observation only. I do not wish to see like a fly in the wall view of whatever's going on in my house.
Mm.
Like I don't want to see myself sitting on the sofa dropping like pad thai under my chest as I watch Netflix. You know, I don't need to see that. But yeah, so I draw the line at internal ring cameras, but the external ones, life changing.
I've got a rear view security camera.
Okay.
We didn't get a Ring doorbell just because I didn't want anyone to actually be able to ring the doorbell and wake up the baby when she was asleep in the middle of the day. But we might get one like after she goes to nursery.
You can't set it so there's no noise and it actually just gives your phone a notification.
Yeah, I don't want to do that.
Sure.
But the security one around the back, like that kind of flicks on like in the evening and stays on till the early morning, and gives me a notification. It was actually a bitch to put up because the kids next door like have a trampoline. Yeah. And so I was like, when they reach like the top of their, like, you know,
it
like
triggers the camera.
Like the zenith of their jump.
Yeah.
Like I don't want them coming into frame and triggering the camera. And they were in the summer, they go out on the trampoline until like 8:30 or something. So I had to spend ages trying to arrange this so that it didn't get like a single kind of like centimeter of the trampoline in view. But then I got a notification in the middle of the night the other night. And when I looked on it, the cat from next door, who's called Rhubarb, was just sitting on the wall staring at the camera.
Love it. Love it. We've had a few magpies land on it and just like stare down in it. No, I've set mine up to have the maximum view of all the gardens. Like I'm in for a penny, in for a pound.
Oh my god. Pure... You should just get extra ones, just chuck them over the fences, you know?
Yeah. No,
just
it's
just drone them over and like land them.
It's one of my our house is three stories, so I've considered trying to get up to the very top to put one up there just to have like the absolute super wide.
Oh my god, can you imagine that, what you'd see in the summer, Pete, you pervert?
The only problem is that the quality of the image, once you go past about like 7-8 meters away from it, gets quite pixelated.
Yeah.
So it wouldn't really be that useful. But yeah, life changing. Big fan of Ring doorbells. I spend an inordinate amount of time checking if there's anybody in my garden or out the front of my house. There never is, but the fact that I know that there isn't is comforting for me.
I get that. Sometimes you hear a noise and you're like,
is somebody trying to steal my car?
Am I going to have to go downstairs and just like check this? I really can't be asked.
Also, it's great for cold callers. We get a lot of people leafleting and stuff and knocking your door in the middle of the day when you're trying to work. I'm just like, you can look at it from my like office desk. And I'm like, nope, not answering that.
I wish I could do that. Like, do you have a package for me? No. If not, go away.
Oh, it is good for packages as well because you can speak through it.
Yeah, and just be like, put it there.
Leave it in the recycling bin.
Mm.
Get a Ring doorbell. You never look back. I didn't think I wanted one until I got one, and then I was like, holy fuck. Like, the things that I didn't know were happening are happening, and now I know about them, and that interests me.
Okay. That also interests me because, this is hard to get into.
Yeah.
Basically, there's like a cut through on my road that then goes to like a kind of a pedestrian bridge over a train line.
Yeah.
And there's been like a lot of talk recently among people on our road that they were like, people have been like dealing in this alleyway. And I think that's broadly true. But whenever I talk to people about it, I'm just like, whenever they try and talk to me about it, rather, I'm just like, I'm sorry, but this is just like too Tory for words.
Yeah.
I don't actually give a shit. It's real neighborhood watching, isn't it? Yeah, exactly. I was just like, I just don't care. And Emma really likes it, but only kind of from a gossip perspective.
Sure.
She's just like, is that guy? Like, I mean, sometimes it is like really obvious. The other day we walked past a guy who was just like leaning casually on the wall, like he was waiting for something. We went to the park with the kids. We came back an hour later and he's still leaning in exactly the same position. And I was just like, bro, like,
yeah,
this is a super Ring doorbelly road. There's so much.
They've got the stickers up and all.
But maybe a Ring doorbell would allow, one, me to coordinate my clothes deliveries, and two, Emma to spy on the local criminals.
Would recommend it, kind of find the criminal element. Would say that it's a real like heroin thing. Once you start, you can't stop.
Yeah, but if I want any heroin, then I could just go to the guy's.
You just got to kind of.
Okay. What am I putting in the burn book this week? Main character syndrome, main character energy.
Okay.
I hate this shit. Stupid. I read an article on Eon magazine this week by Anna Gottlieb, and let me find the title. It's called Main Character Syndrome, I think. Why romanticizing your own life is philosophically dubious, setting up toxic narratives, and an inability to truly love, which feels like that subtitle really like accelerates, right? So it's like, yeah, it's philosophically the dubious, and then it's like, you'll never be able to love.
Yeah. Emotionally stunted.
But she makes a lot of interesting points. Like, she's like a moral philosopher, and her point is kind of like, morality is about how we interact with other people. If you think of yourself as a main character and you relegate other people to the status of NPCs, then how seriously do you take their well-being? How seriously do you take their needs? And I think all that's true. I think it does isolate you. I think it does turn you into like basically an arrogant, selfish, like self-worshipping twat. I think it results in stuff like the tube girl thing. I think it results in stuff, you know, like where you see all these people on Twitter or Instagram who are like, this is why I wouldn't date anybody who doesn't earn like the same amount per year as me. Yeah. Or they're like, relationships, you know, like you should date somebody who like pushes you and like activates your ambition and all this kind of stuff. It's just like, you literally do not understand love. I think you're not capable of love. Like, all that kind of stuff, I think, is like an offshoot of the main character syndrome stuff, because it's like, my achievements are so remarkable and my talents are such that everything I do in life must be geared towards the maximization of my own potential and my own kind of dominion over my environment. And it's not like, how can I serve others? Like, how can I connect to the people around me? Mm-hmm. Which to me is like kind of the point of life. But I think it also just makes you an annoying wanker. Like, even Fair leaving point. All this stuff aside, like the people who are like doing unboxing videos now on fucking trains, like people who are setting up tripods on like busy streets in the center of major cities so that they can do fit checks or whatever. Fuck off with this. Get out of here. Who asked for this? Nobody wants it. And I don't know, I just find the idea of there being like main characters, it's just so depressing, because then you're just like, well, you have to say to yourself, either you're a main character or you're a fucking nobody. Am I a main character or am I a fucking nobody? Both of those, I think, are kind of objectionable. If you define yourself as a main character, you're probably a twat. And these people existed when we were young, you know, where they were just like, oh, we're really fun. I love to be the center of attention. I love to be crazy. And like, it's always like, you're the most boring person I've ever met. but you think you're a main character because you're overbearing or just because you're like hot but stupid. But it's basically like trying, I feel like people are so desperate for an aristocracy that they're like, we need to create a new aristocracy, like, which is not based around like whether you have royal blood, but it's based around whether you have like fucking main character energy, yeah. Which basically means, are you hot?
Yeah.
I just find it utterly irritating.
The Riz just, class.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Yeah, the Riz class. The aristocrats. I don't really see how this is meant to serve us at all. And I think...
Well,
yes,
it's not. It's self-serving.
If you define yourself or even somebody else as a main character, you are automatically defining the people around them as NPCs or supporting characters or just like nobodies. And I think that is a really like deeply corrosive way to view other people. People are not means. People are ends. People are not like props.
Yeah.
For you.
Entirely expendable.
Yeah, exactly. For you to like kind of use to make yourself look better. Like they have feelings that are just as deep as yours and talents that are just as great as yours.
Yeah,
and
it's like, it seems like...
I just
like
think
the,
it's disgusting.
It's like Mean Girls energy. Like you can't sit with us. Like Regina George, yeah. But as much as we joke about being Reginas and stuff, we're really quite distant from that. This is like genuinely... Nice. Imagine if you were 28, say, and you had a friendship group that you were happy to... almost shit on the other people to be like, oh yeah, you love to be friends with me because I'm just so great.
Yeah,
imagine being that person at like 28. That's awful.
But there are loads of those people around.
Yeah,
there are loads of those people around. And I just think, you know what, like I had like, I think what these people think of when they think of main character energy, I think I had that when I was about 10. But you know what it was called? It was called being an irritating little fucking show off. Like that's what it's called. And I think that way about like all these, like all these influencer pricks and all these Love Island dickheads or whatever, who obviously are these sorts of people, they're just fucking show-offs. They just worship themselves. They think they're amazing. You're not a fucking amazing. Like, just calm down. And the people who follow you are not like bullshit sheep. They have exactly the same concerns as you. Like, you should try and achieve the belief that other people's feelings are felt as deeply as yours and matter as much to them as your feelings matter to you. I mean, it's the same way when, you know, like if you were ever on dating apps and you'd see people who are just like, who would say shit like, music is like that so important to me. Music is the soundtrack to my life. Or like, I'm the kind of person who can, you know, I can be like silly a lot of the time, but then like I'll just like look at your eyes and have a really deep conversation. Or I'm an ambivert, like I'm extroverted sometimes and I'm introverted other times. It's just like all this stuff, like the assignment of like something special to all these qualities, when what you're describing is like a lot of very basic things that are common to the majority of people. It's based on this belief that you are special and different. Oh, I'm an empath because when people have feelings, sometimes it affects me. Congratulations, you've discovered why art works. Like, that is fucking stupid. Like, so there's all this kind of stuff where I just think, nah, like, these are just people who can't. There's a guy I follow on Twitter. He's just like, just a guy. Like, he has like a few thousand followers and he privatizes his account constantly when he gets followers because he hates it. But there was something going around like this where somebody, she's like some 24-year-old American who was like, this is why I don't date people outside my class. And of course, because she's American, what she means is somebody who earns the same as me.
Yeah.
And all these people are like, you know what? Like, I can't even hate on her. Like, you know, she's so ambitious. Like, she's such a hustler. And this guy I follow just said, I'm sorry, but none of you people will ever experience love. And I was just like, he's fucking right. Because like, if you think of people as... their aim, you know, like the reason that I'm dating this person is so they like make me work harder and make me achieve my dreams, then that person is not a person to you. They are a tool. They are instrumental. Yeah. And that is not a good way to see other people. And I do think it ultimately stops you loving someone fully. I do think it ultimately stops you really being attached to your fellow man, connected to the people around you, to feeling an obligation to take care of the people around you. So I think main character energy, as well as being fucking boring and stupid and annoying, is also actually a bad thing. But let's leave that there.
Sure.
I'm getting fucking wound up.
Yeah. Okay, moving on to my in. This one's pretty short because for me it is absolutely open and closed, should not exist, nonsense.
Ooh.
It just it goes against the it just goes against life in general. Okay. Paid streaming services implementing adverts. Fuck yes. This. This is bullshit.
Fuck this.
This is genuine bullshit. So the major, I don't think Disney have done it, but pretty much all of the streaming services now are running adverts in the middle of the show because they're absolutely money grabbing pricks. And for me, this goes against the entire premise of what these services were set up for. For me, their entire USP of like on-demand streaming services was that you paid a fee so you could access the content at any time you wanted without any commercials. That was the point. You paid the upfront fee and that covered their need to run ads on their services. And obviously I understand that the companies have, well, they've not been struggling. They're not struggling, but their profit margins are dwindling, I suppose. Or they're shortening because people are realizing that, one, the market's super saturated. There are like five or six really, really common services now available that everybody uses. A lot of people are starting to like jump between them, like build up a catalog of things they want to watch, subscribe to one for 2 months, watch all the stuff, cancel it, move to another one. Like a lot of people are now trying to like hack the system because if you were essentially going to buy them all, you're probably looking at like, I don't know, the guts of like 70, 80 quid a month, probably if you get all of them at the same time. So I get why they're trying to look into maximizing revenue or boosting revenue, I suppose. But this isn't, for me, this just is not the way to do it. And the bigger problem is I have with Prime more than Netflix, because Netflix introduced a tier system where I think you can downgrade to a cheaper tier that has ads.
Yeah, you can.
I can kind of make my peace with that because I hold the power in that decision. In that I can continue paying what I've always paid, no ads, or if I want it a little bit cheaper, I can watch ads. At least
it's more like, rather than it being like you pay more to get rid of ads, it's like you get a discount if you're willing to accept ads.
Now with Prime in particular, I pay the same amount, but now they just run two ads in every hour-long program, like two sections of ads in an hour-long program. I'm paying the same amount that I paid when they didn't run ads, and I assume, I haven't looked into it, but I assume there's a tier above what I'm now currently on that has no ads. So if I wish to have an experience that has no ads, I now need to pay a premium. That I fundamentally disagree with that based on the premise of what the platform was designed and created for. And I understand why it's happened. I just think it's absolute bullshit. And we're basically, this is a stepping stone. If you ever go on like a trashy kind of red top newspaper website, they are impossible to read. Not that there's like ever much worth there anyway, but if you ever find yourself on one, they are genuinely impossible to read because you have two paragraphs of text surrounded by 50 different like flashing banner ads and interactive things. And when you scroll, everything fucking goes mental and changes. And then you get scroll through all that. Then you get two more paragraphs and you basically do that for like a 20 paragraph article. It's the user experience is absolutely awful. And for me, this is like a stepping stone to that. I don't think we're that far away from Netflix on, say, the cheap ad model, now having like banner ads, like a little banner at the bottom pops up of an advert for something in the middle of you watching whatever program you're watching. I don't think we're that far off that based that this is now so common and so accepted. We've basically now regressed from what we had at Sky Plus. When Sky Plus was launched and you could start recording, what that meant was you could basically record all the shows you wanted, watch them back on demand and fast forward through all the ads. We are now actually at a worse stage in terms of like commercials being pumped at us than we were then. Because we can't fast forward them. Like we are completely locked in, and the kind of media consumption landscape are now so dependent on these four companies that they kind of know they have a captive audience. And I feel that the advertising strategy is going to get more and more aggressive.
Because like it's a win-win. So like the more aggressive their strategy is with advertising, they get more money from advertisers, but also they make you more annoyed. And the more annoyed you get, the only weapon you have, you can cancel your subscription, but what you're more likely to do obviously is upgrade it. And then they get that money from you. So it's
just such a money grab.
I mean, Netflix just need the money, to be honest. Like Netflix are just desperate for the money.
The problem is that like obviously Netflix were the market leaders, that kind of they spearheaded the kind of this whole on demand. Every streaming service was born out of Netflix, basically. Certainly in the current format. But now that there's like when they did that, there was one of them. Now there's like 15 of them, five of which are like genuinely big. People just don't have the money to go around everywhere. People are making sacrifices here and there. on Netflix, and Netflix are feeling that. So I understand why it's happened. I just think it's bullshit. I think it goes against the entire USP of it. And for me, it's a slippery slope to having, like, if you ever end up on like an American, if you ever watch any of like American programming, specifically sport, the amount of like random banner ads that pop up in the middle of like open play is crazy. Yeah. Like it's something that we in Britain really aren't used to. We see a little bit. Like it's very, very soft for us. Like the scoreboard will be sponsored by like EA Sports, or this particular like statistic table will be sponsored by Opt, whatever. Like you'll have like, it'll be sponsored by like Carling or whatever. I don't know. It's far more aggressive in America, and it's, when you see it, or at least when I saw it, and still continue to see it, I'm like, oh, it doesn't sit that nicely with me. It kind of, it sours my experience a little bit.
It reminds you that you're a consumer.
I'm very, very aware of the scenario. And I guess that America, most Americans are kind of just numbed it now. It feels like these streaming services are going in that way, and that's just grim. Or essentially, like you say, you're going to have to pay, instead of paying £7 a month, you're now going to have to pay £14 a month to have an in any way enjoyable experience per platform.
Yeah, and you don't get extra stuff for that. You just get the absence of things that are annoying you. I agree. I think this is bullshit. Like, it's bullshit. Like, a bunch of these streamers overextended themselves, and then they're just like, right, you basically need to pay to make up for, like, how bad we are at running ourselves as a proper business, because we ordered everything to season forever because we're fucking stupid.
And we continue making all of these absolute shit. Like, the amount of Netflix-produced entities, like, shows that are horribly bad. Your wife actually reviews a lot of the Christmas ones, which I'm really looking forward to this Christmas.
Yeah, she loves doing that. But at least they don't spend that much on those. Like, it's this other stuff where they just like...
It's still a cost.
Because they never did pilots. They never did pilots. So what they did was they ordered everything
for full seasons. Oh, yeah, they ordered full seasons, yeah.
Yeah, so it was just like, okay, full season of this, full season of that, full season of that. And then you're like, okay, well, you're now on the hook for like tens of millions of dollars.
That aren't
rather than
back.
One or two, which is like why people make pilots. Yeah. But anyway... I agree. It's stupid. I don't like being reminded that I'm kind of the product, that my attention is the product. Okay. That brings us to the end of the public episode for this week. But if you want to subscribe, then you can subscribe to us on patreon.com/patrickvs. If you don't subscribe, or you don't want to subscribe, or you can't subscribe, or whatever, we'd really appreciate it if you left us a review. And people who do subscribe, you can always get your questions in via Patreon. We're always looking for suggestions of stuff we can talk about, especially with an international break coming up. So please do get those in. Thank you very much for listening, and we'll catch you next time. Bye.